From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why is a play about climate change being produced at a horse ranch in the San Fernando Valley? Then you might think of Jeff Daniels as a movie star, but the actor, who has two Emmy nominations this year, has made sure that he always had a foot in TV.
For all I knew, that's where I was going to be. I never bought that I should be doing movies, never bought that I should be starring in movies, ever. I don't look like George Clooney.
And why the Emmy-nominated music supervisor from This Is Us makes a point to champion lesser-known indie musicians. All that coming right up.
KPCC podcast supported by National Geographic's Jane, a film by Brett Morgan that profiles legendary conservationist Jane Goodall and the most Emmy-nominated documentary of the year, called one of the best documentaries of all time by Vogue, natgotv.com/FYC. And the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. The Hollywood Reporter hails it as one of TV's greatest comedies. For your Emmy consideration, nominated for 4 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series.
We begin today with a story about a timely theater production. Exactly a month ago today, the Carr Fire in Northern California broke out and became the 6th most destructive wildfire in state history. Fire officials say hotter and drier weather conditions, along with regular droughts, don't help. But this might be the new normal as climate change gets worse. The Carr Fire is now almost fully contained, but for the people of Scott Valley, indeed for all Californians, terrible wildfires are sadly becoming a regular and tragic part of our lives. Now, the Carr Fire is the subject of a new play commissioned by the LA-based Circle X Theater Company. Frame contributor Marcos Najeda has our story.
Octavio Solis is a man of many hats.
Welcome back, amigos. Anything to declare?
That's him voicing a character in Disney's Coco.
Right. Just a slightly quicker tempo.
Sure.
Because I love that. I think it's.
And that's him working with a cast member during rehearsal for his new play, Hole in the Sky, at a horse ranch in the San Fernando Valley near Sunland.
And wash my soul clean!
And while Solis is mainly a playwright by trade and an occasional actor, he's picked up a new profession these days. He's also a farmer.
We decided to change our lives and just become live in a more rural environment. We just needed a change from San Francisco, from the big city.
Octavio and his wife Jeannie now live on a 3-acre ranch, not far from Octavio's current artistic home base, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. They moved there about 4 years ago. That was also about the time when he got a call from Circle X Theater's Kate Jobson, who was fresh out of her MFA directing program.
Hi, I was just finishing graduate school at UC San Diego. And in my last
Jobson met Solis back in 2010 when she helped stage one of his plays in the San Francisco Bay Area. Solis encouraged her to go for a directing MFA. She took his advice, but her life took a turn.
And in my last month, as I was supposed to be finishing up my thesis, I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. And then I had to come to LA, find all new doctors, do all the surgeries, do the radiation, do all that in my first few months in Los Angeles. So that was my welcome to LA.
So yeah, if we can get you forward sooner, that's a great idea.
That was really this shift for me and a big moment of change in my life.
And Jobson says being sick made her think more about wellness, including the health of our planet. So she told Solis that she wanted to create a piece of theater with him about water, people, and fire, and the strife those factors create for Scott Valley, the area in rural Northern California she calls home. It's not far from where the Carr Fire still burns, and only about an hour's drive from Solis's ranch. Solis interviewed ranchers, tribal members, environmentalists, and politicians in Scott Valley and throughout Siskiyou County. He asked them how they were solving the problems that arise as the Earth's temperature climbs. Those conversations became his new play. Solis says the fictionalized story revolves around true fights over local groundwater and streams.
The Scott River is one of the rivers that people have been drawing from for years for their water, for irrigation, and for their cattle. Every year, that river has had less and less water in it. It's become a kind of problem because there's less snowpack in the mountains every year. Sometimes there is none. It doesn't snow.
Low levels in the waterways means tough times for local Native American tribes who depend on healthy salmon runs to keep their hatcheries and fisheries afloat, says Solis. On the flip side, the farmers and ranchers need to draw out the river water and groundwater reserves to irrigate crops and hydrate cattle.
They're all kind of at odds with each other. And somewhere in between is the truth.
And that's when conflicts come. From legal battles to town hall squabbles, fights over water rights can pit neighbor against neighbor.
And somewhere in there, we have to find ways to kind of take care of each other and not attack each other.
To capture the spirit of the rural region where the story is set, Solis and Jobson agreed to stage the production at a working horse ranch here in L.A. The Courtship Ranch was a fitting choice. The Creek Fire came dangerously close to destroying it last December. That blaze prompted fire officials to issue warnings that dry conditions and higher than normal temperatures signaled more trouble ahead.
The people who are seeing its effects the most immediately are the ones who are most resistant to kind of say it's climate change. And why? Because they've seen this before.
Again, here's director Kate Jobson.
And that's part of what this is how do we overcome our personal traumas and be able to really come together to face these larger issues like changing climates, droughts, fires, these things that are happening to us that we feel powerless against sometimes.
Connor.
But that's no dream, Daddy, no dream at all. I see it there upon the ridge there.
The protagonist of the show is named Connor Bledsoe, the prodigal daughter who comes home to find her town fighting over water and threatened by wildfire. The character is inspired in part by Jobson, who grew up with people always disagreeing about the environment. Jobson says her dad still raises trees back home, and her mom is a water biologist who helped negotiate water trusts in the area.
One of the projects my mom worked on when I was really little was getting the river in our valley fenced off from cattle so it would be clean water.
Jobson recalls how community members, including her mom, came to a compromise.
It's not that you never bring cattle through the water, especially if your ranch is divided by the river. It's just that we find ways to minimize that, to fence different sections of it off. And so it's finding those kind of compromises sometimes that aren't all or nothing solutions that people can still live with.
Both Jobson and Solis hope their new play can offer glimpses into different viewpoints where no one is really right and no one is really wrong. But all can agree that there's much work to do and much more to learn.
We haven't seen drought, and yet we confront it every night. Every time there's a moon up there, there's a place that is beautiful, gets sun almost every day, you know, but not a drop of water. And we look at it and we forget that's what this could be. There it is, like a hole in the sky.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Hole in the Sky will be performed August 24th through September 23rd at the Courtship Ranch in Lakeview Terrace. For more information, go to circlextheater.org, and that's theater spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E. Coming up, Jeff Daniels goes from Dumb and Dumber to Kill a Mockingbird and lots of places in between.
KBCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Genius Picasso, starring Antonio Banderas in his Emmy-nominated role as Spanish painter Pablo Picasso, one of the most influential and celebrated artists of the 20th century. Antonio and Picasso both hail from the same hometown, Malaga, Spain, where the production spent several days filming, including in the same house where Picasso was born. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information.
And the HBO drama Westworld, Time proclaims it's one of the biggest shows on Earth. Live without limits in a world where every human appetite can be indulged. In this hit series, a group of android hosts deviate from their programmers' carefully planned scripts in a disturbing pattern of aberrant behavior. Chaos takes control in the second season of Westworld. For your consideration, nominated for 21 Emmys, including Outstanding Drama Series.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. For Jeff Daniels, Dumb and Dumber was a very big deal. Seriously. Sure, he won an Emmy for Aaron Sorkin's HBO series The Newsroom, but it was the lowbrow Jim Carrey movie that proved he had acting range. As the Hollywood maxim has it, dying is easy, comedy is hard. And Daniels' range continues to grow. Right now, he's getting ready to play Atticus Finch in Sorkin's Broadway stage adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. And Daniels has 2 new Emmy nominations, one for playing this scary guy in the Western Godless, a Netflix limited series created by screenwriter and director Scott Frank.
Y'all been baptized? Y'all wash your bodies once a week?
Have you committed adultery, ma'am? Have you betrayed your brother, sir?
Daniel's other Emmy nomination is radically different. It's for Hulu's The Looming Tower, based on the Lawrence Wright book about the infighting between the FBI and the CIA pre-9/11. Daniels plays John O'Neill, an FBI agent running counterterrorism in New York at the time.
He had a hunch about this guy named Bin Laden before Bin Laden was, you know, Bin Laden, and really didn't have any following or anything.
Okay, f*** this. I'm getting justice to rim through an indictment on UBL so we can do this ourselves. We got to give him something.
He just had a hunch about this guy, and he stayed on this guy. And when the USS Cole got blown up, he started to put Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden together, and he went down to Washington and met with Richard Clark and the people at the CIA and Condoleezza Rice eventually, and just said, this guy, it's this guy. And for a variety of reasons, people just wouldn't pay any attention to him. One was his approach. He was a bull in a china shop. You don't go down to Washington and clean people's desks off when you're trying to get something from them. And that didn't go well. And so he was not liked, but he was right.
When you are playing somebody who is a real person who also has a documented history of being a philanderer and being kind of emotionally colorful, how do you figure out what those motivations are? And do you need to? Do you need to figure out what's in his mind, what his objective is, what's motivating his behavior? Or do you work backward from the behavior to figure out what you can figure out as an actor might be a motivator?
The short answer is you go from what is the end result? What's the script say he does? What is the behavior? And then work backwards to walk into that, to get into that. And in the last 5 years or so, particularly with Godless and Looming Tower, maybe even some with Newsroom, don't understand everything. You don't have to know why you're doing what you're doing. Your shrink's appointment is next Thursday. So you don't have to
do your therapy on
you
set.
It was fun to play Frank Griffin and Godless and John O'Neill and Looming Tower as if they were chasing something. Certainly O'Neill, to have a wife, a family, and in the show, two girlfriends, and there were more. You go back to his FBI partner who said, John gulped life.
That's a great line.
And I just taped that to the inside of my forehead and played.
I want to ask you more broadly about material and about language that you have had recently the privilege of working with Aaron Sorkin, with Lawrence Wright on The Looming Tower, and Scott Frank on Godless. None of them are working at a movie studio. And in fact, Godless was going to be a movie that Scott Frank couldn't get made. As an actor, what is it like to have that kind of material in front of you? And are you now kind of platform agnostic?
I'm interested in what's happening now. I'm interested in what's happening in the next 5 years. I think many viewers are platform agnostic. A good story is a good story. And you're seeing the rise of television. And the reason you're seeing the rise of good television is because of the writing. That's where the writers have gone. You have movies still being made, but there are a lot of comic book movies being made. And for actors and writers and directors who want to tell stories about the human condition and some of those movies that, you know, are people talking, and Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and HBO and Showtime, they'll do them. As an actor, and I've been doing television since the 80s. I would do TV movies. I'd do HBO movies called Cheaters. I did something with Brian Dennehy, Jack Presser's story. I had a foot in television the whole time. I wasn't doing a series, but I was in there because for all I knew, that's where I was going to be. I never bought that I should be doing movies, never bought that I should be starring in movies, ever. I don't look like George Clooney. This doesn't, and they keep hiring me. So you do Dumb and Dumber just to make sure that they know you can do comedy so that when they get tired of you in the dramas, now you've got a range. Now you got Clint Eastwood going, if you can do 2 days in the Valley, that drama, and you can do Dumb and Dumber, you can do Blood Work. So now you're working for Clint Eastwood. You're all, and then Broadway in the theater. Man, if you want to get your chops, if you, as a young actor, if you want to really do one thing that's going to help you in film and TV, do a long run in a play. I don't care if it's regional theater, Broadway, off-Broadway. I'm telling you, I, as a supporting actor with theater in my background, if you're in a two-shot with a star, an A-list star, you have to be great every time because we're going to use the one where he or she is good.
We're talking with Jeff Daniels about a couple of things, including The Looming Tower and Godless. I want to talk about the Emmys for a second. You have two nominations this year, one for Looming Tower and one for Godless. Do those nominations mean something important to you at this point in your career? You won in 2013 for The Newsroom.
You can deny it all you want, but to get nominated is validation. It's just validation that other people in your business, they can see the bag of tricks. They can see when you're not. They can also see the risk. And I think that's one reason why I might have scored two of them, is that this guy took a risk in Godless, and it paid off. Might not have. I might have been the worst thing in it. We swung and missed, but I didn't. It worked. Scott, Frank, and I put our heads together, and we guessed that it was this, and here comes an Emmy nomination. Same thing with Looming Tower. It's like validation that whatever your approach is working. And don't change that. Keep taking risks. Keep challenging yourself because people will notice. And the next thing you know, it's a great day on Thursday and you're getting two nominations. It does matter. And if you win, I'm sorry. It's just for that moment, you're one of the best actors in the world. It's a moment. Hang on to it. But it matters. And but if you don't, and somebody else in the category, especially a friend, it's great. Because that's the one thing. I remember going to the Tonys for the first time, nominated, and I looked around. I said, oh, I get it. It's a celebration of a lot of great work.
Is this for God of Carnage?
Yeah. Because I'd never been nominated for anything. The only thing I said it in the Emmy speech at Newsroom, I said
anything. The last thing I won was in a few years ago for Squid and the Whale. I won the Best Actor Over 50 from the AARP.
Literally, it was my only trophy at home. God bless the AARP. And I went out to the hotel to get it. I wanted it because it's a little golden Barca lounger with your name on it.
That's a cool trophy.
It's a cool trophy. So it's prominently displayed at my home.
You also said something else that night.
The great American playwright Lanford Wilson said, whatever you do with your career, make it matter, make it count.
Make it matter, make it count. How does that show itself in the choices that you make? How would you define that in a practical sense?
Well, you can't. It's a wonderful goal. It's a great artistic goal. And I think I did that with Newsroom. When Aaron Sorkin writes something, it matters, it counts. He is saying something. It isn't just something that you're going to forget tomorrow. You know, popcorn entertainment. Same thing, Godless said some things, pretty violent things. Looming Tower said something. And To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway that's coming up is certainly saying something.
I want to ask you a couple things about To Kill a Mockingbird and about why you think it's important now and what your reaction was to the idea of Aaron staging it.
I think it's so important now. I'm memorizing it right now. We go into rehearsal in September and we open in December, so I'm about half memorized. And there's a thing that happens when you memorize a script. Also, an Aaron Sorkin adaptation of Harper Lee. And you start to hear, there's a Harper line. And it's as if someone was tweeting it today. He didn't change a word. And, you know, and we're adapting it, but it's still all about the book. And you start to go, this is set in 35 Alabama, but it's right now. It's right now. And the way that show just is still alive, more so now than ever, as divided as we are, I'm real interested to see the reaction because it's going to be pretty honest. Very honest adaptation of a great, great book.
Jeff Daniels, great to see you.
Great to be seen.
To Kill a Mockingbird opens on Broadway in December. The Looming Tower is on Hulu, and Godless can be found on Netflix. Coming up on The Frame, the music supervisor for This Is Us breaks down her Emmy-nominated episode. In 2017, the Emmys introduced a new award category for music supervision, and that means that industry veterans like Jennifer Pykin can finally get recognized for their creative contributions. Pykin is nominated for her work on the NBC hit series This Is Us, but her resume goes back more than 20 years to films such as Happy Gilmore and the TV series One Tree Hill and Felicity. Pykin's music selections for This Is Us range from familiar artists like George Harrison to undiscovered indie musicians. When she spoke with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett, Pykin discussed her duties on the show and where she finds new music.
I get music from all different kinds of places. Like, I was at, like, the little local ice cream shop in my neighborhood, and the kids were playing music in there. I'm like, what's that song? Hi, I'm Jennifer Pykin, and I'm the music supervisor for This Is Us. I guess basically what I do is I curate the music for a TV show. I help pick all the songs. I come up with the sound of the show. I feel like the sound of the series started in our pilot. We used Sufjan Stevens' Death with Dignity, and that was an indie artist.
Spirit of my silence, I can hear you, but I'm afraid to be near you, and I don't know.
So sometimes when I use music in background scenes, they're not bigger artists, they're just small indie artists. One of my favorite examples, I was sent a Bill Fay cover of Jesus, Etc. And that's a cover of a Wilco song. A lot of times you use a cover song, it's a new artist covering an old song. And this is an older artist, I don't know, he might be in his 70s, who covered a Wilco song. I get these gut feelings like, oh, this song would be good for an episode. And it kind of has that down-tempo feel that we tend to use, and it's really kind of emotional.
Jesus, don't cry.
The song was used in the scene. It goes back and forth with Rebecca in the hospital talking to baby Randall when he was born.
You are the luckiest, prettiest, sweetest baby ever named after a Steely fan.
The vocal of Bill Fay, it's just very gripping, and it's just so sweet at the same time.
Melodies turning your orbit around.
And the label actually said, I got an email from Bill saying, can he thank me for the usage? And I remember reading it in the car with my husband, and I started crying because it was the sweetest thing, getting an email from this man. He's like on the other side of the world. I think he lives in the north of England now. And it talked a little bit about how much it meant to him and about what was going on in his life.
Our love is all we have.
Usually the small indie artists, they're the most appreciative. They're usually the ones that either come by my office or track me down or come by with like a bottle of wine. I'm like, and thanking me for something so they can pay their rent, they can make more music, they can feed themselves. It means something to them. And on top of it, it also helps them get credibility or possibly sign to an indie label. And so for me, I'm a big champion of indie artists because I can see the difference it makes. So for this Emmy-nominated episode, I had a song written for the episode, and the song's called Where I Belong. Basically, it's teen Kate's application for college. She needs to turn in an original song.
Kate, your original songs are gorgeous.
Oh, hey, that face and that voice, what if I videotaped it?
I'd rather die, so I'm just going to send in an audio tape.
You don't want me to videotape?
That's not happening.
We only had 2 days to do this, by the way, which is a crazy short amount of time. So we went out to a handful of writers, but one that really stood out was written by Elise Davis, who is based in Nashville.
I'm gonna get out of my head.
And her lyrics were, I'm gonna get out of my head and into the world, and I'm gonna say my goodbyes to the scared little girl. And it sounded as if Teen Kate had written this song.
I'm gonna find where I belong.
Dad!
No, keep going.
So the song was almost done, but we brought Sid, our composer, in to kind of add his special sauce to it. He tweaked it a little bit, worked with Elise, got it done over the weekend. And on, I think it was like Monday or Tuesday, we shot the scene.
Into my heart, gonna find all the strength I had from the start.
We think about what Kate would listen to. In a previous episode, she's listening to the Pixies in her bedroom. In another episode, she's going to an Alanis Morissette record signing party. So each character has definitely a theme going through it through the whole series. So I kind of put myself in their shoes and try to think about it that way. The other side of my job is getting all the rights to the songs. You know, we're in the second season of This Is Us, so this season it's made it a little easier because people do know the show and are fans of it. You know, part of my job is relationships with the different record labels and the publishers, especially for the iconic artists. And we used an Elton John song this year that was pretty cool. Bruce Springsteen. We had used a Van Morrison song. George Harrison. Oh, my God. We got two George Harrison songs. And we had to go to his estate, which is his widow, Olivia Harrison. And thank goodness she's a fan of the show. And we used All Things Must Pass. And it was the demo version. It's really, really great when lightning strikes and everything comes together and we get to use something that maybe people haven't heard of.
Sunrise doesn't last.
One final note today, be sure to check out 1A tonight on KPCC. I'm joining host Joshua Johnson to discuss Crazy Rich Asians on the 1A Movie Club. We talk about the film, its importance to Asian audiences, and whether or not it will change Hollywood's poor track record in telling similar stories. And that'll do it for The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.